Let's roll. This is Countercharge, your podcast for ranks, flanks, and kings of war. Join your hosts as they delve into the world of Panathar and bring you worldwide coverage of all things Kings of War.
Welcome to Countercharge. I'm Alex Chavez.
And I'm Luke Frizen.
And I'm wrapping up, and we're back again. This time we're going to chat all too early about the five new scenarios that they put into Clash of Kings 2025. And I'm excited to have Alex and Luke joining us again. The community has really enjoyed hearing people pontificate about potentially winning ways to handle these scenarios with the different armies. You know, we'll dive right in. Let's take a look at two ones we had from last year, Hold the Line and Stockpile. And how have your thoughts changed on these two scenarios from when they were first conceived last year? Are you playing them differently now? Have you come to some great conclusion?
Yeah, I'll start on Hold the Line. I remember talking about it last year. You know, we kind of talked about it as being kind of just dominate plus. I think it was just like a better dominate. It was just kind of a more balanced. And I think that opinion's been validated in really the way you see the scenario played. I think it's just a very much more interesting scenario. It's played out in kind of how you expect it. It makes the fighting for the middle really, really important. But I always love seeing wins where people have either side of the whole line. Like you take the two sides, you win with 4 points. So there's just a lot of, to me, it's a very dynamic scenario. It's always changing. There's a lot of different ways to approach the problem. And to me, it's much more interesting. I'm really happy with that scenario. I think the way it's developed has been really, really strong. Really, to me, one of my top scenarios that if I'm hosting a GT, I'm going to always try to put it in there. If I see a GT with it, I'm always kind of expecting it there. I'm always happy to see it there. I think it's a very interesting scenario in that way. That's one that I've been super pleasantly surprised. I think that, you know, the RC did a really good job with just kind of making sure that they kind of introduced a scenario that was different enough and really, to my opinion, just better than some of the previous scenarios.
Yeah, it really does have a lot of that dominate plus energy. And in that respect, I'm not quite as hot on it as Alex is. Pretty good scenario. I'm a very lazy setup player. So if I cannot have to measure out tokens, then I'm probably going to be happy. So for that, it's nice and easy as well. It's just that strip across the center. At the end of the day, it's hold two zones. And if you want to do better in the tournament, you want to hold the middle zone as one of your two zones. So it's pretty good. You gotta contest at least a big chunk of the board. There's a couple different ways you can approach it. It's pretty good, yeah.
I think we play slow armies, it gets better. It's easier to kind of not have to worry about getting too far across the line, you know, is it?
Yeah,
true. It keeps it margin.
When you guys dominate, you know, I also see it as maybe a compressed control. Instead of the six boxes, you only have the three. Whereas control leans to armies that have more units. You know, you can really spread out, and this kind of compresses it. I think it's almost like a midpoint between dominate, where you have one zone, and control, where you have six zones. I just like the flavor that it brings, because every type of scenario like this, whether it's dominate, control, hold the line, it's going to work differently with different types of builds. I think that's just the spice of life.
The one thing I like about hold line, I'll say, like the last thing I'll say about it is, like, I think it does a good job of balancing a little bit between the number of units, total unit strength, how much you need to kill, how much you need to defend. I think it kind of is somewhere in the middle in all of those things. So I tend to be a balanced player. I like playing balanced lists for the most part. So to me, it kind of meets that middle ground where it's like, you know, if you have 20 scoring units, you're not like just automatically ahead like you would be in control. Might lean to smaller drops and higher unit strength kind of armies, but to me, it does achieve a balance, I think, that is desirable in most scenarios.
Another nice thing about it is it doesn't come up very often, but because the scoring zone is only 12 inches wide across the center of the board, you can get zoned out of it. Like it's a lot harder to pile your unit strength into than dominate or control. You know, control has more zones, dominate has just the one, but like it's pretty easy to fit, you know, four or five regiments or large infantry hordes into that 24-inch diameter circle. But a 12-inch wide strip, if you're not in control of it and your opponent sort of pushes you off, you're maybe only getting one or two units onto it. So you've got to be a little more careful about making sure there's room for you on that thing, which can be very cool.
The clarification they did where it's like majority, that was kind of the change, I guess, if you want to call it that. You know, first at one point, it was like, you just need to put your toe in, you count as being in it, and like, I think majority completely agree to your point, Luke. Like that's like majority makes it very tricky to actually kind of get there. And you do have to play somewhat aggressive. You can't just sit back and go, you know, oh, turn six, I'm going to move up into it and score. That's not really a good strategy in that scenario.
Yeah. If you try that, you may just get zoned off entirely.
Mm-hmm.
pretty rare in King scenarios.
Well, let's jump in and talk about Stockpile. You know, Stockpile to me is the proto progressive scenario. Yeah, you don't score early, but if you don't get up there and start pulling those tokens early, at the end of the game, you're not going to have the tokens. So in my mind, I've kind of come to see it as almost like it isn't progressive in the sense you're scoring the points early, but you've got to engage early and get up there and start yanking those tokens off the pile so that you have an opportunity late game.
You're right. You're absolutely right. But I think I wish that there were maybe one more loot token in each pile, because in playing it, I've been a little disappointed that it's not as restrictive, really. Like I haven't found it's that big of a deal to get both tokens over two turns. Now, I play a pretty aggressive melee army, so that's probably going to factor into that to some extent, because I want to be pushing right up to that midline as soon as possible, regardless. It hasn't been as much of an obstacle to park in the middle of the board as I figured it would be when I first read it. It's pretty good. It's sort of the same thing. You have to contest the middle fairly early. And I like loot tokens in general just because of the stat changes they have to units. And that's sort of a nice way to mix up sort of the otherwise like somewhat static threat range game in Kings. Like, you know, you can drop them before a charge and et cetera, but you better have something else to pick it up after you do. So yeah, it's treated me pretty well. I just wish that it was a little more awkward, I guess. Like if the scenario fought you a little bit more, I think that would be a little more dramatic, a little more interesting.
Well, and also if you had more tokens of the piles, it would make you have to commit to holding the piles longer.
Yeah.
Because right now, to your point on the two on the left and the right, you can get in and get out within two turns.
You do still run into that situation like in old loot, where at the end of the game, you've got five loot tokens on a 70-point piece of chaff. If it survives, then you win. And if it catches a fireball, then you lose. Because it's now, hoping I'm understanding correctly, it's only the scenario loot that changed it. So the loot tokens are one victory point per unit.
Only push is the one where you only can score one token per unit. Also wonder on Stockpile if they should go to the route of if you get the loot token on the other side of the table, it's worth two. It's sort of like a pressure luck kind of thing. Go up there and get the tokens, but press the advantage to potentially get more.
Sure.
Yeah, it just feels so easy to grab the tokens. Like, you know, like you said, they're only 12 inches away. I mean, it's super easy. Even on turn one, you can just like deploy your units in such a way that you grab both tokens right away.
It seems like it should be harder.
I completely agree. Like, that's one that I kind of like thought in theory. I thought it was, oh, it's super cool. I love the idea of having to, you know, control this point and continue to control the point. You know, it's almost like they're testing the waters a little bit on what a progressive scenario would look like. And maybe that's what they were doing. But yeah, it doesn't accomplish that goal, I don't think, at all. And I'm kind of surprised they didn't change it, to be honest. Like, I thought, like you said, either making it so that only one you can ever grab a token a turn was at least, like, at the very least, makes it so that you can't just, like, turn around and on, like, turn six and grab two tokens right away or something like that, right? Because I agree with you. It's almost a non-factor, really, to grab tokens. I played a little bit of Green Lady this year, and I remember playing the scenario where I just kind of, like, you know, like, all right, I'm going to smash this at a table and then turn around and just like grab them later. And like, who cares? Right. It's like, it's not really slowing down at all. So I don't know how you counter that necessarily or how you think about that. Maybe make it so you can't grab more than one, maybe make it so that like certain turns you can grab them, certain turns you can't grab them. So there's kind of maybe these like key turns where you have to grab them in advance. Like, I don't know. There's a lot of ways to kind of play around that. Yeah. I kind of agree that Stockpile to me is not quite there, but it is still interesting. I do think it is at least different than loot, and loot to me is always kind of like the most basic, like kind of boring scenario ever. So like, to me, this is still just better loot, I think, than so I'll say that at least.
Always play pillage over loot, and I would probably always play Stockpile over pillage. So in that respect, it's good.
And I do think it's different. I think it is in the right direction. So that is like a very good thing.
And in terms of the loot token scenarios, we've got push, we've got loot, we've got plunder, we have Stockpile, and we've actually got some other ones that we'll talk about, like Seek and Destroy. You know, where do you rank Stockpile? Is it kind of the middle of the pack?
I like Plunder a little better. Plunder's my go-to, if you consider. I guess it's kind of weird, so I don't know if you call that loot, but that, to me, Plunder is the best of them. I'd probably put this right behind it.
And I think loot, for me, is the worst.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's only three tokens. If you're going to play loot the scenario, just play Plunder, right? Because then you got five tokens, and it's interesting in the sense that two of them worth 2 points. At least that's something a little bit different. And Stockpile puts a wrinkle on that. You still only have the three piles or the three spots for tokens, but there's multiples there. And then Push, the fix from last year is good in the sense you can only score on, you know, one token per unit. That has changed things a little bit.
It feels like trying to force more speed 5 infantry into the game, which I guess I admire, but it's not really working. So
yeah, I mean, to me, it ties into a kind of more interesting question. Like before we get into the new scenarios, I do find it really interesting that none of the scenarios were kind of removed or none of those scenarios even adjusted in any ways. I thought, to me, you know, I think 5 new scenarios is amazing, and as soon as we get to talking about them, I'm super excited to talk more about them. But why did the old ones kind of not get removed? Do we really need, you know, what is it, 19 scenarios?
Yeah, we have 19 scenarios now.
I think that's a bit much. Like if you ask me, I think that we could have looked at loot and said, yeah, we don't need this one anymore. You know, we can take this one out. You know, maybe dominate. Hey, we got better dominant now. We can take it out, right? So I think, you know, you asked a really kind of interesting question there, Rob, which is like, we kind of have, a lot of people agree that these scenarios are kind of better versions of these other ones. Like, do we still need these other ones? And you know, do we need such a big pool? Or do we not? You know, I wonder why they didn't test them or try to adjust them in any way based on the feedback. Like you said, maybe loot counter is going to be carried by one unit like that, or scored by one unit. That's, I think that you could roll that out for all loot tokens. That'd be a perfectly fine change. I think that'd be a very interesting change, you know, to kind of what most scenarios try to do. So I'm kind of, to me, going into this, I'm like, I kind of wish they had experimented a little more with like kind of removing things and just, you know, changing some of the other things. I think just adding new stuff is good, and new stuff, I'm always happy to see new stuff, but I'm a little confused why they just left so many scenarios in the pool. I think that's going to confuse a lot of people in reality.
You also count the narrative scenario that they added, that we have 20 scenarios. Part of it, though, is that we don't use all the scenarios, right? Like, a lot of people don't play with the bluff scenarios because it's kind of random. My theory here, they're giving us 20 scenarios to play with, and we'll give them feedback. And then when fourth edition drops, we're back 12.
Yeah.
That's my guess.
Yeah.
What you guys are saying is all true, but you guys are very smart. And TOs that put these events on, they know which ones are better for a competitive event. I think it'll get sorted in fourth edition. But to your point, Alex, it is a little strange, though, because if a new player is coming to the game and there's literally 20 scenarios, it's like, well, which one do you... I had a conversation with Dylan Scribner not too long ago, and he brought up a very interesting comment. He said, kill's not a scenario. That's just playing the basic rules of the game. There's no objective there. You're just demonstrating the rules.
Right.
There's a bunch of scenarios in here that don't see the table very much.
Kill can go, yeah. Everyone can be happy to see kill go. I mean, I don't get it. And like I said, there's 20 like scenarios. Like, how many people are going to play 20 games? Like, you know, how many games do you have to play before you play the same scenario twice? Like, it's almost like it's you know, it's a little confusing when you're like, oh, wait, I thought I remember how to play a scenario and I don't. And I've seen people even know better, like misname scenarios, kind of misremember scenarios. Like, you know, it's they're really tricky when you think about it. And to like, I like a nice, concise pool of scenarios that kind of, you know, are refined and kind of, and I know TOs will do that. And don't get me wrong about that. But like, to me, I think, yeah, I would have liked to have seen that push from RC to kind of narrow it down. And I hope they do that in the future.
I do like, though, in the Clash of Kings book that they've bundled them together collectively, like under objective scenarios, loot token scenarios, because as a TO, I'm always conscious of, well, I don't want to have 3 loot token scenarios in my 5-game event. So let me give you a loot one. Let me give you an objective scenario, maybe give you an area control type thing, whether it's invade or dominate or something like that. Now we have progressive scoring as a type of scenario. So it's nice that they're put the thought into how you would categorize these. Well, let's get into the new one because we just got done talking about, you know, stockpile. Let's jump in and talk about the new loot token scenario, which is called Seek and Destroy. It's new for Clash of Kings 2025. And before rolling off the two sides, place 7 loot counters on the board. The players take in turns to place 1 loot counter each. Roll off to see who places the first loot counter. If a unit routs an enemy unit that is carrying a loot counter in melee, they may elect to destroy the loot and remove it from the table rather than pick it up. Victory points are awarded at the end of the game as follows. 1 victory point for each loot counter you control. It's very similar to a lot of their loot token ones. The difference is you now have the opportunity to kill it in melee. You wipe it out, you don't get it either. What are your guys' initial thoughts on this?
What you're saying is true. There's also a really, really big factor here, which is that these loot counters aren't starting in the middle of the table, right? You guys are deciding where to put these loot counters. And it's a couple of things that right off the bat I kind of look at and I kind of raise my eyebrows like, wait a second, like what's going on here? Because one is, there's 7 tokens every time, which is fine, but that means that inherently that player that wins that very first roll off is going to get to put 4 of them down and the other player is going to get to put three of them down. So there's already an imbalance right at the start. And that's kind of my main take when I look at this. And this one is a bit of a thinker. I had to kind of really wrap my head around this there for a while to kind of think about, like, how do you play it? How's it going to actually look on the table? Are people going to stack one side of a bunch of tokens? Are they going to like fight there? Are they going to put them all around the middle and kind of play that way? And I don't know how it's really going to turn out. This is one that I'd be really interested to see next year, how you know, hopefully either I'm wrong or right to see how it works. But to me, it strikes me as a very imbalanced scenario. I think inherently, like, there's going to be a lot of skew. I think that there's going to be people trying to stack tokens on one side of the board. And one thing I don't like about it is that it's a scenario you can kind of win by not moving out of your deployment zone if you kind of do it properly, right? You can kind of stack one side of the board, loot a whole bunch of tokens and go, okay, well, I'm winning the game right now. So, you know, it's over to your side to kind of do what you want to do. And that's pretty rare. I don't think there's really any other scenario that can do that. I mean, I guess pillage to a degree, but really you don't see that very often. And I'm curious to see how this plays out. But I don't inherently like it because it's, again, I wished that they had seven, but one was in the middle, but like something to get the action going, right? You need something to kind of give an initial push to, like, you know, to do something. And not, to me, having the scenarios kind of all player determined is a bit wonky, and I don't know how it's going to play out exactly. But my brain thinks players like to skew things, like to create skew armies, and I think this is one that is a little bit ripe for abuse in that way, and making skewed games. And I don't know if it's necessarily one that I would look forward to. I mean, I think loot tokens is good, and having a lot of loot tokens spread out is going to be something that, like, an army like a Force of Nature, someone that's looking to surge a lot, like Undead, is going to hate this because they're going to have to pick up a whole bunch of these tokens on different units. So you're going to have to not want to slow your army down and that stuff like that. But in the same way, I think there's other armies that are like wanting to defend a lot more are going to love this scenario for the ability to kind of hunker down and just be winning the game, you know, kind of just right away. So that's kind of my initial impression on this scenario. I think there's a lot of ways to really play it. And I think it is going to take time for players to figure that out.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it means there's a certain amount of spreading you've got to do, you know, like salt the earth. Typically, whoever has more scoring drops will want to spread them out more because they can, you know, sacrifice a goblin regiment to hang out on one. Now, this one here, you can't destroy them unless you're killing the enemy unit. That's going to be interesting. You've got to carry those around. I'm not sure if it's ever going to be the right call to destroy a token. Like, I guess if you're using an individual to kill something, and you've got nothing nearby. On first read, I'm not that excited to play it. The player placed tokens, often somebody decides to do something weird and it makes the game weird. Like it's not really a good play to stack them all on one side because it's before deployment, right? Or before rolling to choose sides. So you've only got a 50-50 chance, well, approximately a 50-50 chance of getting the side you want. Yeah, I'm not excited for this one.
I see this as going to be played like pillage, with the distinction that these are loot tokens rather than objective markers. And I think what would have made this better is if you would have got 2 points for having the loot counter on the other side of the table, because then that might have incentivized people to pick them up and actually try to do something with them rather than sitting in your deployment zone. Don't forget, we got a bunch of war engines that have unit strength 1 now that can pick these tokens up and control them. This does not incentivize them to move, right? Just sit on the token.
I mean, here's the question, right? If I put a loot counter like in the very corner of the table, like what are you going to do about that, right? Like there's some armies that can't answer that well, right? Like you have to basically stick a unit in the very corner and try to pick it up, right? And then, you know, it's just inherently give, like, you know, saying, okay, I have an extra unit or a faster unit that can get there. They can still like get to the fight. You know, there's a lot of things going on there that like are like, it skews the matchup a lot. And again, I agree. Look, I don't look forward to playing this. And even if I'm playing that skew army, like you said, you, with pillage, people already tend to stack. I mean, stacking, I agree. It's like 50-50. You lose sometimes, but for a lot of armies, that's like, hey, I'll take that chance, right? Or like, and that's just a weird game. It's not a very interesting game a lot of times, right? It's like, you know, it's like, well, this game was kind of already predetermined. So I wish that like there's a little bit more restrictions on what zone where you could put the tokens. Like maybe like make it a zone where they're gonna be placed, or like, you know, like every other loot scenario has had that. I mean, from my understanding, it's the first really loot scenario where you're kind of able to just throw them wherever you want, right? So this is them experimenting a bit in that regard, and I don't know how it's going to go. I mean, it's definitely interesting. I, you know, the part like in the, I didn't really think about individuals killing units. That is kind of cool, where you can kind of like maybe using the vigils to kind of like, you know, kill those corner units or whatever. I mean, that's kind of like maybe something that you need to think about more now in repertoire. Also, something I meant to say at the very beginning that I didn't, which I need to give a massive caveat to everything I say, because I haven't actually seen any other rules in the whole Clash of Kings. So just in case I sound stupid and like there's a secret rule that like changes everything I say, then like I have a wave of immunity. If there's a command that like negates everything I said, then just assume I didn't see it because I literally didn't see it. So I only know the rules of these scenarios so far.
Rob is really setting us up to look at.
That's my intent.
Rob setting us up here.
Bring up a good point, though. There are commands now that can move units backwards at full speed or sideways at full speed. Potentially, you're picking up the token at the end of a move. You know, those command orders could come into play to get the tokens. Alex, I think you're right on comparison to this in Salt the Earth. I think if it had the distinction of putting one in the middle like Salt the Earth did, most of the time it's going to be relatively balanced. Probably have three on one side, three on the other, one in the middle. But with this one, it's like pillage, and usually there's four and three. And if you lose the roll, well, then you're probably an upward battle. I guess, though, the distinction, though, is even if their person's got four, and if you have an Alpha Strike army, you can go in there and kill them. And wipe the token, because you're not carrying it, so you don't have to pick it up and be speed five and no nimble, no fly, and you can still kind of go in and just hold your three and destroy their four.
You can also do the thing, too, where I sit on the objective, or sit on the token, but I don't actually pick it up, right? I can do, there's kind of that gaminess to it still, where, like, you saw a lot of that, too, where, like, oh, I can just sit on the token and, like, not only on the rules, you can't pick it up as well, which is that's a rule a lot of people don't know. Like, you can't pick up tokens when an enemy is touching it. That's like one of those hidden rules that a lot of people don't realize, that like enemy is touching tokens can prevent you from picking it up. But you can also just sit on top of it, cover it with your footprint, but not actually pick it up until turn seven or six, you know, because that's all that matters in this game, in this scenario, is like whoever holds it at the very end. So I can just sit on that token, and if you alpha me and kill me, then, well, I didn't have it. So you have a choice now. What do? You try to grab it, and now I'll kill you, or you're sitting there, and I'll kill you, and I'll grab it later. So there's a lot of like counters that's going back and forth. I mean, I think you're right, Rob. Like, I would have loved to seen like one in the middle or some sort of restriction on where he plays. I mean, that's one of the things we didn't talk about pillage, talking about older scenarios. Like, I think most people agree the best version of pillage is kind of where there's seven tokens and there's one in the middle. Like, that's what I've seen a lot of TOs adopt that as a kind of the standard, like, pillage now. And that's one of the things that didn't get addressed either, like in the original scenarios. They said, hey, yeah, you know, right out of the book, technically you can play a five token pillage. That's what you get, right? Like, you know, again, I was curious to see. They didn't touch that either. But I think this is a scenario where, like I said, it's a little wonky, and we'll have to really see how it plays out, because I have no idea. I really don't know. If I'm playing this, I'm going to be doing weird stuff. I'm putting tokens in the corners. I'm going to be trying to spread my opponent out. I'm going to try to be doing all sorts of weird stuff to make them make all these tough decisions that like they weren't ready to make in a normal game of Kings of War, right?
Well, let's get in and talk about the new objective scenarios. There's two of them. We'll start with the first one, which is called Protect and Raise. After rolling off the two sides, place one objective marker in the exact center of the board. The players then place three more objective markers 6 inches from the center line on their opponent's half of the board, rolling off to see who places theirs first. Take it in turns until all the objective markers have been placed. You cannot remove the central objective or objective markers on your own side of the table. Victory points can be accumulated from round two onward and are as follows. One victory point for each objective marker you control on your opponent's half of the board at the end of your player turn. Claimed objective markers on your opponent's half of the board are removed from play. One victory point if you control the central objective marker at the end of the game. One victory point for controlling each of the objectives on your side of the table at the end of the game. What are your thoughts on this scenario?
I think I hate it. I think it's worse raise every time. The placement of objective markers on raise sucks. I've always hated it because you can get into really wonky situations where if you understand the restrictions on placing objective markers and you place the first one, you can really screw over your opponent and control where those go because you can't drop them within 12. And it's a little bit better if you pretend that objective markers don't have any diameter, so you can deploy them directly across from each other. But if you don't ignore that, then it can be like really restrictive, especially if there's any terrain, like blocking terrain you can't deploy within 3 inches of. So raise can be a real pain in the neck to deploy, and it can be pretty abusable if one player understands it better, like just has dealt with it more. This one here, it still suffers from that. And then you don't actually have to be aggressive. You can just protect your three tokens and the middle one and win, right? So you're not forced to cross the middle of the table. And in the event of like a bit of a blowout where one flank, you know, really collapses, whoever is winning wins more by scoring the ones you remove, like in Rays, and they're also going to score their own friendly objectives on that same side of the board. My gut read is that I really hate this scenario, and it's just worse Rays.
I mean, Rob, you said there's overlap in Rays. Like, this is literally Rays with like one sentence added, right? I mean, I think verbatim, it's Rays.
Right, you could score your tokens on your side of the table.
Yeah, that's literally it. So, I mean, yeah, it's like that's a little odd. And look, I'm glad you got off the point with like the diameter thing. Like, I've always played Rays with no diameter because I think you're right. Like,
it plays better as you do.
You can make so you actually mathematically you can't even place a token. Like, that's actually the way that it works out. So like you like according to the rules, you just literally can't put a token down. Like it's ridiculous. So like you have to. I think to Tio's and I wish I had clarified that in this scenario. Like, you have to play Rays without a diameter because that's the only way this is a playable scenario in my opinion. So you need that to be there. But yeah, I do agree. This does reward defensive play a little too much. I think at least you have the center objective. That's the kind of only pushback and like argument I'll make to encounter is that like at least there's some center play there. So like if I can control my defense and push the center, there's at least some initiative there, right? It's not just like sitting back, right? To me, there's at least I deserve the win because I at least had the middle and the back three or something, right? So that's the only like defense I'll make. At least there's something that has to be done. You can't just sit back on the back three and win the game, which you know you can do in some like the other one we talked about, right, with the loot or something. But
and it's not like it's trivial to defend like the entire breadth of the board. You know, like you don't have to go very far up, but that's wide, right? Like it's really tricky to hold a line 5 feet wide. Like that's it.
And I agree. And that's something that you can play some. You have some control of that. And a lot of times you see alpha armies, they'll kind of like. You know, they'll throw their units in there and they'll die, but they'll burn the objective or something, right? And they'll just kind of do that in a way where they can at least like burn a couple and defend. This does at least offer some like different alternatives of scoring, which I don't mind. I think in this case, I'm kind of curious to see how this one plays out. I don't mind it too much. I've actually seen people play this as a custom scenario before, so this is actually something that I've seen one of our TTs had this as sort of a custom rule. So like, I think this is something that kind of felt very natural to me, like in general. So I kind of expect this. And I don't think it doesn't change Rays that much overall. I think it's still kind of the same scenario. I think you still employ more or less the same strategies when it comes to this scenario. If anything, it maybe rewards people that can kind of stack one flank more than another. Cause if you have the ability to kind of roll down a flank, you can kind of score it, like your back ones while attacking. So like there's some, to me, there's a little bit more like if you have a better way to stack your army one third of the table and push that, you can kind of put scenario tokens in a way where that wins you the game where it maybe didn't before. I think that's something that's a little different, but yeah, I think it's not that different from Rays, right? Like in reality, it's said and done here. You're kind of, you know, operating that same realm. And again, I think Rays is fine. I don't think it's that bad necessarily. I think it's something that you have to be really careful about. I mean, I always tell players, like, if you're talking more of a strategy point of view and like you're giving advice, I always tell people, like, you just got to make sure you're really careful what your opponent can charge and burn off, right, when it comes to these tokens. Like, if you're guarding a token with a unit, like, you just got to make sure you're counting the unit strength of that unit. Because, again, it's a number of times I've seen people like, oh, I have a unit there. And it's like, well, I just charged and I'm large cat, or, you know, I'm unit strength 4, I'm a horde of whatever crap, but I burned the token, right? Because I still exist, right? So it's like, that's something that I always tell people, like, if you're playing the scenario, like, make sure you're very aware of it. Like, a lot of times you want to put two units around the own objective so you have enough unit strength combined that you're not just letting your opponent get it for free, right? Because again, make them at least work for it, right? If they kill your unit and they burn it, that's one thing, but they just walk up and exist and they burn the token, then you probably did something wrong. So like, that's the one thing I kind of tell people is like, be aware of when you're playing this scenario, like count your unit strength, count where units are, like be very aware of that and kind of, make sure you're always playing that properly. Cause I mean, I've been guilty of this too, where like, I just didn't quite account for certain movements and speeds. And next thing you know, you're playing on the back foot cause your opponent burned a token that you thought you're defending. And now you're having to kind of like run around. But again, to me, I really love that there's a middle token in this. And to me, that kind of makes that interesting dynamic. We're going to talk about it more, I think, with some other scenarios, but like, I love the play where like you're kind of fighting around the sides. And at the very end, it's kind of collapsed to the middle. Right. And I kind of love that dynamic.
There should probably always be a middle token. Eh?
Yeah. Right. I mean, and again, and I love the idea of like the fight. We're fighting on the sides and that's all that matters the first five turns. And then turn six, all that matters is that middle token. So it's kind of like, you know, you on the left, you on the right. Now we're going to meet in the middle. Like, I love that kind of like thematic style of battle that you see there, mm-hmm. where it's like, it's going to see, all right, it's like you won the right, one left, let's see who wins the middle. And it's a big clash. And that, you know, you get those battles, I think, to a degree with Rays. And Pets and Rays, I think, you know, it's similar style, maybe a little bit more favorite to the people who have more drops and more scoring units. Again, like Rob said, if a War Machine scores, which, you know, that's kind of cool. I didn't know that was a thing, to be honest. But if a War Machine can score and you can just sit it, like, you know, I can maybe walk it towards the token or whatever, because, again, they're pretty close to, like, your deployment zone. You can maybe deploy near it with the intention of, like, later walking to it. That's something that, like, you got to make sure you're playing when the scenario is like, okay, well, I'm going to have units defending it, but end of the day, toward turn six, those units should be pushing towards the middle. I need something that runs up behind it to score it. And that's, you know, that's an interesting sort of, like, skill discussion where, like, you need to have that plan. You need to have a sort of strategy around that, right? And that's where units with one units really, really do a lot of work. So, like, you know, if I play dwarves, and I use a dwarf example, I play sharpshooters a lot, right? And sharpshooters, that's their bread and butter, right? Moving into spots, scoring things. I mean, especially with ordered march, they're phenomenal with ordered march, right? They can pivot, go at inches. They're scoring these objectives all day, right? Like, I can just put two units on it, hold it. Those units push up, maybe they see an advantage, they attack somewhere, and then my sharpshooters pivot and score that on turn six, right? That's a very easy play to do. If you can do War Machines now, that's even better, right? So I think that's just something that I highly recommend most players, like, look at now and try to plan around and kind of play around that.
And just a quick public service announcement. War Engines treat obstacles as blocking terrain, and they cannot move at the double.
Sharpshooters, to me, are still king when it comes to, like, they do and what they actually accomplish on the table. Like,
I guess plus shots.
Yeah, I've had games of sharpshooters do, like, zero damage the whole game, and they win me the game. It's like oh, that's like three or four units that's just scoring all these points, and, like, you know, they didn't shoot a thing, but at the end of the day, they're what were in the right spots, were because I deployed them that way, or they just happened to be there when I needed them. Players need to be smart and plan out, and definitely when it comes to War Machines, especially the ones that, like, the flamethrowers of types, right, that kind of want to move up and shoot, like, you got to be really aware of that wall rule, because I've seen players, like, that's a rule that's been there forever. And, like, yeah, I love it. I think you see it less nowadays, but, like, yeah, back in the day, you see people, like, I'm like, dude, you don't know, like, they're behind a wall. Like, what are you doing, man? Like, that's going to be a problem.
My favorite thing in life was at Michigan GT reminding Shannon that his trombones couldn't cross to get my siege breakers to win the game. I was like, nope, you're stuck, brother. You can't get me. I'm out of range.
Oh, that feels good.
Yeah, I'm just going to move half an inch backwards. Oh, sorry.
It doesn't happen very often, Luke. I got to take my wins when I get them. Another thing about Protecting Rays that's interesting, though, is I wonder if it's, you know, they have Rays, and now they have Protecting Rays, if there's going to be some discussion of which one makes the cut for 4th edition, maybe. But also, if you think about it, you know, Rays itself, you only have a 4-point spread, right? You can only score 4 points in that game. That's the most you can score. This one does have the potential to give you 7, and it does change the dynamic in the sense that when you kill a token, it's almost like a swing of 2, because you're getting a point and you're taking a point away from your opponent.
Usually on Rays, there's, like, a strong side and a weak side, I've found, because, like, typically, and, like, if we ignore my complaints about setting up the scenario, I actually like it a fair bit, because you have to decide how much you want to invest in your defense, knowing that probably those units are never going to score any victory points. I like that tension of sort of a fast side, slow side, strong side, weak side, trying to figure out, you know, how much you want to split up, how hard you want to push. I don't know if there's really functionally any difference on the table between, like, a 4-0 in Rays and a 7-0 in Protected Rays.
The way you tell them scored usually is, like, if you burn one, you score 2. That's like, the in scoring perspectives, like, that's how it was played in, like, Blackjack. So, like, that was... The fact that it's super confusing, if you look at Blackjack, like, you, each one you burn is 2 in Blackjack turns, but it still counts as 1 as a scenario point, right? So it was, like, awkward and confusing, and no one really understood it. So I do like that this makes more sense. We're like, oh, there's 7, you know, potential points. There's 7 points, right? Like,
it ties in a little more nicely, yeah.
Yeah, it's a little bit more linear. It's a little bit more straightforward. And I agree with you. Look, I love the flank battles. I love mm-hmm. the, like, hey, I'm going to put, like, you know, 300 points of garbage here, and they're never going to win. They're never going to score anything, but their whole job is to slow you down, make you wait, make you back up, make you do, you know, like, I love those battles where, like, that's kind of my bread and butter when it comes to Kings of War. It's like, I always kind of do this calculation of how many points can I put here to tie up, and how much are they tying up? Are they tying up double their points? You know, is it 1.5? Like how much points do they have to hold up to be worth it? And that there's always that kind of interesting dynamic to me of, like, these flank battles. And I agree, the Rays very much encourages that. I think some other scenarios we're going to talk about later and encourage that as well. And I think, and I, to me, that's one of my favorite parts about Kings of War is like figuring out those battles, those calculations of like, you know, it's a classic kind of like chess, you know, trading. We're trading pieces here, right? Like I need to make sure I get enough value for my trades and can they stall long enough, right? To me, that's classic ranks and flanks. Like that's like, where can you make the sacrifices and trades you need to accomplish the objective, right? Mm-hmm.
Let's get into the next new objective scenario. This one's called compass points. Place two objective markers 12 inches from the table edge along the center line. Each score one victory point for controlling it. Place two objective markers 9 inches from the center line from the exact center of the board.
So on the 36-inch mark, 9 inches forward, 9 inches back.
It's like a cross, basically. Yeah, so you've got two on the center line, 12 inches in, horizontally long ways, and then the center of the table. Vertically, you've got two that are 18 inches apart.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Give me a map, right? Like, just draw a map, man. Like, what are we doing here, right? Like, it's a lot of these scenarios, you just draw a map, like, explain that. You can explain, like, raise even. You can throw the lines. Like I think there's a little scenario goes a long way when it comes to these points, right? But I think the intention is clear. Like, I think we all agree, like, where they should be, right?
So this one, victory points are awarded at the end of the game as follows. One victory point for each objective marker you control. Two victory points for controlling the objective marker on your side of the table. Three victory points for controlling the objective marker on your opponent's side of the table. Question, is this cumulative? The one on their side of the table, is that you get the first point and the 3 points for four?
I don't think so, but it's not clear.
Not wordsmith the best. Not clear.
I agree. Yeah. Like I thought the same thing too. It's like, is it one? Is it one, two, like two, three? Like what happens here? Right. And it's a little confusing, but I think again, we kind of use that 7-point scale as like the standard, right? Like 7 points in a scenario is kind of where most scenarios end up. And I think using that, the 3-2-1 means that there's 7 points available for if you have all of them, right? It's like three for the other side, two for yours, and one on each side. So for now, that's the kind of assumption I'm going to look at this under that lens. If not, that changes everything. But let's kind of go for that for now, I think.
The trouble is it's closer to a 6-point scenario. Three is only for your opponent's side center. So if you divide the table diagonally down the center, that's going to be how this plays out a lot, right? The center toilet bowl, you pick one flank and the center. Then you've got 2 points for your own 9-inch off the center line and 1 point for the one on your flank. So you're at three, your opponent's at three. Then what happens?
Right.
Like you're either fighting over the extreme opposite side or you're pushing right through the middle. And if you get the one on your opponent's side, that's worth three. So even if they have both flanks, that's only two. I think that the allocation of points on this one is going to make for boring games.
It is interesting, right? Because like in theory, there's only two scenarios, two points that matter. It's the north and south, right? That's the only ones that matter here. Like basically, in theory, the side ones, you don't really give a shit about. Because like if you hold the middle two, you win every time, no matter what, right? Yeah. But there's not really an easy way to do that, like at least going down the middle, right? You're not going to like walk your army up the middle and just get like smashed on both flanks, right? But so like there's some I think it's like there's some confusion there. How you're going to execute that game plan. I think like Luke said, it's probably going to see the armies kind of like going around each other where they kind of like, you know, tornado whirlwind around the center and kind of like, okay, well, I need to hold mine. That's super important. It's worth 2 points, right? I'm going to anchor around that. And then I'm going to send my things to really attack your center as fast as possible. And it's probably around a flank, right? So I'm going to, it really encourages like loading one flank really hard. And for that, I think that does encourage that kind of play we talked about where it's, I'm going to really alpha and blitz one side really quickly to try to win it. Because if I need to do that to push to your middle, right? And I need to win your middle because that's basically the only way you win the scenarios if it's taking their middle point, right? Like that should be your game plan from the second you deploy is how do I get their middle point, right? And then second question should be how do I do that and hold my middle? And that's really all that matters in this game. Yeah. It's like those 2 points. But it is different, I'll admit, because that's really a different question that we've seen in a lot of scenarios. Because those points are like kind of far from each other and they're in like – and having units in those directions is very kind of awkward, right? It's not like, to me, it's not inherently easy to do that, to like have two units there, especially at the end of the game. So I think there's an interesting question here. I don't know how it's going to shake up. This is one where I'm kind of admit that I've kind of had to wrap my head really around is like, how would I really play this? Like, do I just like, I think I just alpha one side and I just go hard and I just, you know, hope that I am able to push the middle and win it. And I don't know if that's good enough. Again, it's hard to say. I mean, I think it's just, This is one that I could see this being a very draw heavy scenario where it's just too difficult to do, because it is. I think it is difficult to hold yours and to take your opponent. I think you're probably going to do one or the other, and I think doing both is quite challenging.
I don't see any reason not to brick up. Like you have no reason for the objective. Like, you know, ignoring the terrain and the armies you have, there's no reason to spread out. The scenario completely rewards absolutely concentrating your army into a hammer and just smashing through, which is the most boring kind of scenario, I think. If neither player can do that, then it's going to be a draw, like a lot. And if you have speed 10 flying hammers, then I think you will have a massive advantage in this scenario to be able to reach out and touch into that sort of deployment zone on the opposite side. I think this is a dud.
I like the idea behind it. I like the idea of it.
It's cute.
The 12 inches is pretty far on the sides. Like you like,
yeah.
To win those, you're gonna have to play wide. Like and that's sort of an like. Is there a game plan where you like can take those and hold yours, and maybe that's like a small win? I don't know.
I just think it matter is the thing, right? Like
yeah.
If you hold both and lose the center, you lose. If you hold both and hold the center, you win. But that's a pretty big ask. And if your opponent breaks your center and you only hold the flanks, you lose. Like on hold the line we were talking about, if you have both flank zones, you win 4-3. You know, it's a marginal win, but it's a win. So like you have to contest those flanks. This one here, I think the flanks are a trap. Like if you happen to have a scoring unit in the neighborhood, you get one victory point. But if you change your game plan to score either or both of those and your opponent really commits to the center, then assuming sort of, you know, equal luck, equal skill, they're going to win. That's the better game plan is to go for the center every time, I think. You know, I haven't played it.
The ones on the flank, they're 4 feet apart.
Very far apart. Yeah, very far apart. Yeah, they're really out there. I mean, 12 inches on the side of the board is very far, like out there. Like it's slow army. Like you're not going to win. Like if your opponent's fighting you for that, you're not going to meaningfully win that and get to the middle to be a meaningful factor there. And that's where I think I agree with Lou. Like fast armies have a massive advantage on this because they love seeing this kind of scenario. I can fight you in the flanks and threaten the middle simultaneously, right? Yeah. And if you can do that, you have a massive advantage. That's what I was saying. Like if you trying to break up in the middle and you're exposed to that sort of game plan, which I mean, at least where I play, like, you know, you're going to see speed 10 flyers, like they're, you know, every other corner, you see speed 10 flyers everywhere. So I think you're going to see that a lot. So I think they are advantageous in this scenario. I do agree that the scenario, it would have been more interesting to see a more balanced distribution, maybe a 2-2, 2-1 or something like that. Like where it's like, you know, holding yours is only one, and then like you're kind of rewarded to move out and do stuff. You know, would you take a risk to like lose your middle? Probably not. So that means where are you going to put the risk? You're going to put the risk on your attack, and that means you're going to like just alpha in general is going to be what you want to do here. And so those armies are inherently advantaged. And you know, I would love to be wrong with this. I would love to be wrong on it, because like, I think if there's a way to like slowly grind your way through and get the middle and hold both, like that's awesome. Like that's an amazing game plan. I don't know how would you do that, but like, you know, especially if there's like speed 10 flyers you have to deal with, like there's just too many angles. Like you're not going to hold that and get like you're going to get flanked, you're going to get killed. Like there's just too much shit going on to really hold those 2 points opposite, which is very, very tricky from a game plan point of view. And it is different. And I do respect that it is a different sort of like game plan than most things have sort of worked out so far. So I like it for that regards. You know, if I'm looking at this from a strategic point of view, I'm probably just slamming one side as hard as I can and just like putting as much like stupid defensive stuff in my own zone that like can hopefully sit there and shoot the opponent and just like prevent them from holding it. And just hoping that I just end up on top.
Yeah, the scenario doesn't really change the thing you want to do anyway for your army.
I'm curious. It is the most different. Well, I guess we have the other progressive one, so I shouldn't say that, but this is like different. Your more standard game plan. Like it is going to change up things. So I'm hopefully going to get a couple games of this soon and see how it plays out, because I think this would be interesting from that point of view.
This is definitely the most unique. from what we've had in the past, whether you compare it to Raze or Pillage or Salt of the Earth, right? It is different. Again, though, when you only have four tokens, you can each have two, right? Like it's the same thing we've said before many times. With one in the middle, it gives you that odd number. There's a tiebreaker there, and we don't have that. So and the two on the flanks are 4 feet apart. So that's going to be a refrain when we get to one of the next scenarios where they also have scoring zones that are very far apart. In that case, 3 feet apart. Some armies have a hard time splitting and spreading out that much.
Totally. I mean, yeah, I wonder if they play test this where, like you said, what if they push the two in the middle kind of up to the deployment zones and put one in the very middle, right? And they kind of, like, I'm curious if they test those things out, because, like, I think you kind of want, I agree with you, Rob, like, you want odd number of objectives in general. Like, that's what you want. Like, the balanced, you know, tokens just, like, it rewards too. It's too easy to draw. Is kind of the way I look at it. It's too easy to, like, sit back and, like, get a draw. And a lot of people take that, to be honest. Like, you'll see that a lot. Like, it's like I'm gonna wait for my opponent to make a mistake, or maybe, like, they're gunning for the win, so they're gonna take more risks, and that's my advantage for them to do that, right? Like, that's something I don't like to see. So I do agree with you. I would have loved to see, like, a more, you know, odd numbers, like, worked around. I wonder if they tested that. I'd be curious to see that. But again, this is one that I'd love to be wrong at, right? Like, I hope I'm here to look like an idiot and this is, like, the best scenario ever. That'd be cool.
Well, let's get into the most exciting new category of scenarios, which are the progressive ones. And, you know, we've had lots of chats about this. There are places in the United States and overseas that have been doing progressive scenarios for a long time. I don't know, guys. This one feels like it comes up a bit short, but this one's called Bulldog. It is a loot token-based scenario with progressive scoring. So after both players have deployed their forces, each player places one loot counter within their deployment area, giving them to a unit to carry if they wish. Roll off to see who places their loot counter first. Victory points can be accumulated from turn 3 onwards. Each player scores points at the end of their respective turn. One victory point for each loot counter you hold on your half of the board. Two victory points for each loot counter you hold on your opponent's half of the board. At the end of the game, total scenario victory points accumulated for both players to determine the winner. This has got a lot of potential points, right? Because if there's two tokens and potentially you can go from turn 3 to 7, that's 5 turns they can score on. And if there's two tokens worth 2 each,
20-0 is the perfect score in this game, yeah.
There's a lot of potential points here, but it's maybe not like that because there's only 2 loot tokens. I'll just start. They need something in the middle. It feels like a rugby scrum where I'm going to push on the right and you're going to push on the left. It's progressive push, but without the center tokens. I don't know. What are you guys' thoughts?
So I can envision the type of game that the person writing the scenario wanted this to play out as, and that scenario sounds pretty cool, but I'm pretty sure that 95% of the time, the person that wins is going to be the person that kills the opposing unit with the loot token and takes it. Because the number of points do not really matter. If you get both loot tokens and you're scoring double, even turn 6? I haven't crunched the numbers, so forgive me. But because there's only one loot token each, it's wildly swingy. So if you win on the part of the board where the loot tokens are, then you win Bulldog. So I just don't ever see it happening that it's this, like, interesting, you know, back and forth where you're protecting your scoring unit and trying to fend stuff off. There is too much flying alpha and too much shooting in the game to make that realistic. Yeah, I don't see it. Alex, am I missing anything?
No, I mean, this one's a tough one. Like, I don't even know where to begin when it comes to the snare. Like, there's so much going on here. Like, so much. Again, I agree with you. Like, missed opportunity in some way. Again, there's a cool theory behind what it's trying to accomplish. I agree with you on that. Like, I think that. But, like, yeah, I absolutely agree with you, 100%. Like, all it takes is one combat to win this game. And to start with, like, there's such a massive, massive advantage to having more drops than your opponent in this thing, right? I mean,
in every scenario, yeah.
Yeah, in every scenario, probably to agree. But in this one, like, in Pillage, if you have an extra unit over here, they're like, I don't really care, right? As long as, like, I know what we're playing around anyway. It's like, I can account for you dropping something there randomly, right? In this game, like, if I can put a unit that's somewhere where you're expecting it and I give them a token and you didn't have an answer for that, then you've already lost the game, like, as far as I know. Like, So you have to play wide in that regard. Like you have to assume your opponent's going to do that to you, right? So if they have another, if they have one more drop than you, they're just one more. It's all it takes, right? Then you have to assume you have to play the whole field, because if they drop it somewhere where you're not ready to defend, and they just put their bulldog token there and they just walk over and you don't have an answer for that, then you've already lost this game, basically, as far as I can tell. I mean, at best you're going to get a draw, right? Absolute best you're going to get a draw, because they're going to score 2 points for that token, you know, for the 5 points here you have, right? So you're going to get 10 points there guaranteed. And again, that means that, like you said, all they do is kill your unit one time in any point. And that's all they have to do, and they won this scenario, right? And so that's basically, I think, the brass tacks of like what it's going to come down to. I think you have to play wide. And so it just makes a very weird scenario. It's just, you know, to start with, where's the center token, right? We've been saying that kind of through like all over the place, but here, like, it stands out more than anywhere, right? For a second, like, I see this, well, I thought it was cut off. I was like, oh, like, clearly I missed it. Like, there's got to be like more, something more to here, right? It's like, no, it's like, that's it. You have one and one. Like, without a middle token, like without a middle objective, without something, like the amount of draws you're going to see in Bulldog is going to be ridiculous, right? I think like you used to see it a lot even in Invade, I think, where players would kind of sometimes go, well, I'm going to put a unit here on this side of the table on the right. The opponents go, oh, I'm going to put it on my right. And you have kind of like, and usually like in theory, someone did the math wrong there and you had to have this weird scenario where like, okay, well, someone did the math wrong. And so then there's a last minute scramble, or maybe it was a draw from the get go, right? I think you saw it with some other scenarios too. Like, I think you used to see with push sometimes, like if you ever saw someone, you ever see anyone play push where they forgot to put the middle token in the like objective? I've seen that for sure. And it's like, the game's a draw. We just kind of ran around each other and protected our token. And you know, the game was a draw. It's like, well, what happened in the middle one? Like, oh, there's a middle one. Like, you know, you kind of get that mentality. Like, oh, yeah, like that's the whole point of the game. Like the game doesn't work without a middle token and push. And I think this is just push without a middle token, right? I think that's what it comes down to. Like, this is just, those like, very like, you're just gonna like, there's no reason to ever risk your token. You're gonna put it in the safest place possible. You're gonna make sure it gets across, and you're gonna score your points, and you're gonna just do stupid, crazy things to try to kill your opponents for one turn. But again, it's like you have to kill it in combat, really, because otherwise you don't score it. Like if you shoot it, they just pick it up and keep moving with it or whatever. Like, I guess, you know, there's a couple things you can do with it. I guess now, again, if there's some crazy command that lets you do something that changes this, then by all means that might change the rules here. But there's just so many things. Like that makes this, I think it's a very poor scenario that like really encourages people not fighting, right? That's kind of what comes down to it.
And because there's only two tokens, it's much swingier than push, for example. Like it's basically swingy push, right? So any army with the ability to exert force very flexibly or very far away, shooting Alpha Strike, has an inherently huge advantage in this scenario, because you desperately want to hide your own token, just like you're saying, and hit your opponent's token. Yeah, that's a really good point about number of scoring drops too. Like a 70 point zombie regiment, if it's left alone on the extreme flank to just walk up. I guess zombies are a bad example because they can't move with the double. Or I guess they can now, can't they?
Yeah, so why don't you just use their command order that lets them not have shambling for a turn?
Trash, like goblins, zombies, if one is uncontrolled and you don't have the ability to rapidly redeploy or reach out and touch it with some shooting or some flyers or what have you, then you're done, right? Like it's bad enough when it happens on push and they get one token across uncontested. There's only one token in Bulldog. I don't even know how you'd phrase it. It would probably have to be like a whole paragraph of text, but something like, if the unit holding the loot token is killed, then instead of the usual loot token priority, if you could pass it off to a friendly unit within six or something, maybe it has to be closer to your own board edge.
Oh, just like rugby. That'd be awesome.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm imagining a version of the rules that are fun, where you can afford to play the scenario in a fun way without just immediately losing. And that might be cool, but it would also be ridiculously wordy. So
yeah, that's a thumbs down.
I think there's a lot of games that they're just determined by turn four. It's like the game's already over. Like, it's like, we know what happened. You maybe took one risk, it didn't work, or you, I have one turn to shoot you before you move behind an impassable, and now I can't get to your unit, and it's just safe on my side scoring, and that's just the game. Like, I see that happening a lot, and I mean, like, I mean, again, the counter to that, again, if I'm giving strategic advice, if I'm saying, hey, this is the scenario, you have to play it, like, you need to play wide, you need to sort of, like, find a way to attack multiple angles and try to do that, and you find a way to get your token safe, like whether it's putting behind your units and then just pushing up and making it so your unit can't get charged, so at least they're safe behind your unit, and then like maybe they'll run around and they'll try to you know, again, you're kind of loot tokens, you're restricted what you can do, but you know, like that's kind of the game plan here. It's just like it's not entertaining. Like you're not trying to like actually engage your opponent. You're trying to avoid them. In most situations here, you're trying to find a way to like kind of aha, let me pick up their unit and kill their unit quick enough. And again, like I said, even shooting down a token can be effective, because if you shoot down a token, you can only pick it up by ending on it. So if you like, you know, if you can shoot a token down on turn three, like, oh, I got top of three and I'm gonna shoot your unit that's carrying it and I killed it, then I've already won the game because you can't get that unit across the table. So like I'm 1 point up now. So like that's all it takes to win this area, right? Sometimes like if that's all, you know, and that's kind of how I see this going. Again, I would love to be wrong, but I don't see it here. Like this one is. It's just there just needs to be more factors in the play. There's just not enough tokens, not enough play, not enough like wiggle room here. It's just too basic. And again, give me at least a center token. Give me something to fight for, right? Give me something that makes sense here.
Yeah, if we play progressive push though, that's a game changer, because you can only score one token per unit. So there is no taking three tokens and getting them over there and then distributing them. You've got to, on turn three, they've got to be on three different units relatively early in the game. So this is just one that maybe needs to go back into the think tank and get reworked a little bit. We'll see. We're always doing these things way early, and we're probably, yeah, you know, I'm probably way wrong, and I'm probably going to find out, oh, this is my favorite scenario. But in my limited playing of the scenario, it has not been my favorite scenario. Well, let's get to my favorite new scenario. And this is also progressive, and it's called Rack and Ruin. And I believe this is a shout out to Steve Hildrew, because I think he is the creator of this, or the progenitor of this scenario. And Rack and Ruin, place an objective marker in the exact center of the center line.
Great start.
There are two 12-inch scoring zones set 18 inches apart from the short table edge and 18 inches away from the center objective. So essentially, you got two dominate circles, 18 inches off the edge, and 3 feet between them, center to center.
So there's a 1 foot gap between the circles.
Correct. There's a 1 foot gap between the edges of the circles along the center line. At the end of rounds 3, 4, and 5, add up the unit strength of all your units that have the majority of their footprint within the 12-inch circle. One victory point for each circle you control at the ends of 3, 4, and 5. So there's 6 points available there, right? Because you can get 3 from the left circle and 3 from the right circle. In addition, one victory point for holding the objective marker. So there's 7 points available. I played this one. It is very perplexing because unless you're playing for the 1 point win, right? Where I'm going to hold one side, they're going to hold the other side, and we're going to fight over the middle, which you could do. Because you're scoring on 3, 4, and 5, if you really want to win big, you sort of at least have to contest one of the circles that they may be going hard on and holding the other circle yourself. And your army is split into, you know, potentially into 2 pieces, 3 feet apart. Certainly there's some armies, like maybe orcs, that can play the length of the table, but there's certain other armies, dwarves, that, you know, if you only have 12 or 13 drops, it's going to be hard. Of the new scenarios, this has been my favorite because it does ask different things from you. Number one is you're scoring some of the things, you know, 3, 4, and 5, and you're scoring the objective at the end of the game. You know, the points are all over the place and you've got to put a game plan together. So what are your guys' thoughts on Rack and Ruin?
My two first impressions, which I'm very open to being wrong about, because this one's pretty different. I haven't played it. I will have to learn by playing it what I really feel about it. My two first impressions are that the zones are too big. So it's too easy to get onto it. Because, I mean, like, they brush up against your deployment zone, right? So you move up a quarter of an inch and you're touching the zone, at least on those sort of points that are closest to your zones there. So you really don't have to extend very far to be scoring them. My intuition is that I would like the zone more if it was riskier to push up there. And I don't think I like that you don't score them turn 6, because then the only thing that matters turn 6 scenario wise is that center token. There's no tension on, you know, still trying to get that center token, but holding the flanks, you just as much unit strength in the center as possible. Now, that might end up being cool as hell, because you then have to figure out how to funnel your units into that center. And the big zones might actually be good because then you can juggle the unit strength, because it's much easier said than done to decide to win a zone, right? Because it's total unit strength. So your units can be 20, 24 inches apart. And if you've got, you know, two infantry hordes and a couple of troops, you're at 10 unit strength. The other person has three regiments and a Titan. That's 11 unit strength. Like, the zones are big enough that the amount of contesting unit strength is going to be pretty tricky. And that's pretty cool. This is probably a good scenario.
Yeah, I agree. I'm looking forward to this one a lot. I think there's a lot of dynamics here. Again, anyone trying to predict how to play this, I think is stretching, I think, in that regard, where I agree, like, there's a lot going on here. And I'm actually really excited for it. I think if Steve came up, like, you know, hats off to Steve. I think this is progressive done right, I think. I mean, I think the interesting thing about 3, 4, and 5 to me is that round 3 is at least late enough in the game.
It's not turn 2.
Yeah, it's not turn 2. And there's less of a factor of going first, right? You always have that, like, if you go first in a lot of these scenarios, you get such a massive advantage, right? Take raise, take the other ones. Like, there's so much you can do in turns 1 and 2 to set yourself up. In turn 3, like, we're kind of equalized. We're kind of like turn 3, you can't really stop me from getting to a certain spot, right? Like, unless you're, you know, risking a lot of things. So to me, the interesting thing there is that, like, turn 3 is enough to kind of get established here. And also, something that's very, very cool about the scenario is that, like, you score it at the end of your respective turn, right?
At the end of the round, both players get a chance to play in turn 3, 4, and 5.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Yeah, so it's not like some of the other ones we mentioned where it's at the end of your respective turn where you pop
the token. You're right. Yeah, I'm saying the wrong scenario there. So okay. So
going second is a massive advantage in this one.
Yeah, in this case, you want to go second. Yeah, I might have missed that initially. But the point being that if that's the case, you definitely want to go second, because that's actually huge. Yeah, that's actually changing quite a bit, to be honest. So in this case, you want to go second, and you want to have, like, flexible unit strength that you can kind of push where you need it to, right? I think that's something that'd be very interesting. I think Titans are really powerful in this scenario. If you look at, like, flying Titans that are, like, kind of get around, and the ones that are nimble, like, you can push. If you have, like, two Titans in the middle, they can kind of go either direction. They can kind of, like, oh, okay, I need 4 unit strength over here. Zoop, let me zip them over here and get that going. The way I see this playing is kind of how I talked about earlier, where, like, I think you're going to see a strong flank and a weak flank. And I think you're going to have that battle where it's like what I want to do is I want to beat your forces enough where I want to kind of get behind you. Again, assuming I'm playing a fast enough army, right? If you're playing a slow army, this isn't really relevant. But if you're playing a fast army, what you want to do here is you want to overload one flank where you score it and you score it every turn, right? So those are 3 points you're going to score. And you kind of have a game plan around scoring those 3 points. But then also attacking enough, you know, or pushing past that flank enough to attack the center and attack your opponent's flank where they can't leave their flank in time for turn 6, right? And that's what it's come down to, right? Turn 6 and turn 7, you need to be pushing for the middle. And if you've pushed your flank enough where you're threatening your opponent and they have to kind of deal with your threats and they haven't dealt with enough, it's kind of like, again, that tornado effect. It's like, you know, there's a center, you're kind of, it doesn't really matter initially, so we're kind of ignoring it. We're kind of moving around it. You know, I'm going left, you're going right. We're kind of whirling around each other. It's going to be whoever, the first one to kind of get around and faster could have a good advantage. And that's what I really recommend to the faster players, kind of pushing that edge and doing that. And I think I kind of like the scenario where going second is an advantage. That's kind of a rarity. So I do kind of like that's a thing here. I think that's definitely something that's going to be very interesting. Because again, I think turn three, like, I think even if you're playing alpha list, it's so hard to keep your opponent, like Luke said, like, it's so easy to just jump into it and start scoring. It's like, it's really hard to push someone. So I think it is going to see a lot of these flank battles where it's like, I'm going to slow you down here enough where you can't get back to the middle in time. And that's my game plan. And I think, and I like that. I like those flank battles. I like those battles where I can go, hey, I'm going to put 500 points of my army here, and it's going to hold up 1500 points of your army, and you're going to win the right, but barely, and it's going to cost you the middle and the left, and that might be my game plan of victory. And I think, you know, and I'm a player that typically, you know, doesn't try to win big. I think if you're trying to win big in this scenario, you have a very different puzzle to solve in this game. You know, trying to win both zones is very interesting. Rarely does a double split work that well. You know, I mean, it could, again, on the right matchups, but I think that's something that I would love to see how that plays out. One last thing I'll say, like, before I pass it over to you guys to talk about it more, is I think terrain is a big factor for this map. I think I want to make sure, like, any two TOs who host this, like, you need to really account for the scenario with the right terrain. I think there's a lot of ways to like ruin this scenario by putting like an impassable in the wrong yes. place where like, you know, if there's an impassable right in front of the zone, right, which there kind of is. And you look at a lot of these like maps, like if there's an impassable, like in my half of the zone and I can't really get to the zone quick enough. And I just automatically lost that zone just from the get go. Like that to me, it makes the scenario a little bit less interesting, I think, where it's like, you have to really plan around that. So I like to see a more neutral sort of setup here where the terrain isn't as big a factor for armies. And I think that's really, really important, I think, just to making sure it kind of looks good and it's not too advantageous for one side.
Because you've got the two zones and they are scoring on 3, 4, and 5. All of my games, there is lots of combat in both those yes. zones. That's what I did the first time. I was trying to get one of them solidly, and I'm trying to put up a fight in the other one. Maybe I stop you from one turn getting it, and that swings it one to me right at that point. So here's the nail, though. If you're going hard on one of the flanks and you get stopped for some reason, you roll a snake eyes and your whole momentum is stopped, you lose the game. Now you've got to take a whole nother turn to get through it. It totally destroyed the game. I think the play is just try to get one of them. Only give the other player, you know, one or two turns on the, you know, do enough to try to stop them. But I mean, as Luke said, you're next to the zone in your deployment zone. So you move up a little bit. And if you have turn two, like you're fighting very quickly. And if they're moving in to score on three, you're in combat. Even if there's a ton of unit strength out there, it starts to just dissipate because it's fighting and it's dying and it's fun. I will say that it's a lot of fun. And I don't know the right strategy here. But I will say it does make for a more dynamic game because you're also having to make adjustments on the fly because you don't really know how things are going to go.
Right.
If you're going to go hard on one flank to get that circle, you've got to get in there, score your 3 points, and you need to turn and go towards the center. And because by that point, you're not going to get to the other token, right? You're not going to get to the other circle. So really, at that point, you're if you're going hard on one, you're probably trying to win 4-3.
They're only 12 inches apart, right?
Yep.
If you're a human shield wall, that's an impossible distance. But, you know, we're going to have Order of the Forsaken charging from one zone into the other constantly, right?
Definitely, yeah. I think an interesting question to ask yourself right away, like, I don't think you can win the scenario giving up a zone. Like, I think if you say, hey, I'm going to score 0 points here, I think that's a losing strategy, I think, right away.
You've got to put up a fight.
Right, exactly.
Well, I mean, there's that center token, right? Like, if you play this as dominate with a refused flank, and depending on the matchup, you might have to. Like, I've thought of three things while we've been talking about this. One, TOs, you need to get physical 24-inch diameter circles to put on the board, because if you're measuring from a point, you're going to have to do it 50 times a turn, and it's going to burn through the round clock. So this scenario, you really need to know exactly what the boundaries of the zone are, because you really want to, if you're winning a zone, you want to be as sort of little in it as possible. So skirting around the edge towards the center, supporting the other side. Two, going second is probably like a huge advantage. I think that after a year of playing this scenario, we're going to look back and see that whoever goes second has like a 70% win rate or something, because knowing exactly what the unit strength to beat is in each zone, if you have the tools to move it around, like that's massive. But whoever's first has to sort of bid, and then the second player has their whole turn with full information of what that bid is. So that's huge.
I agree.
And three is it changes the tempo of the game in a pretty interesting way. In basic kill, whoever has the most shooting dictates the tempo. And then it's whoever has the furthest threat range. In this one, whoever has the most unit strength does it. Like if you're playing one of those 30, 35 unit strength lists, you move up 6 inches and you park. And your opponent has to deal with that, or else you will score at least one zone every round. So if you have less unit strength than your opponent and you go first, you might just be hosed. And at that point, you might just have to play full refused flank, tie scoring until the end of the game, and then try to smash through the middle.
You brought up a lot of interesting points there. I mean, I think, like you said, if you are that high unit strength army, like I said, your path to victory is scoring both zones twice. You've already won the game. Mm-hmm. If you turn 3 and 4, you control both zones. That's 4 points. You can't lose a scenario.
Yeah.
But the scenario's already over, right? So that's kind of your game plan. It's just shove up as much there and put enough of a force in the middle to kind of say, okay, where's my opponent threatening me, right? I'm going to prevent them from killing my stuff, right? And I do agree with like Rob said earlier. Like this is a scenario where like if you roll snake eyes the wrong time, it's going to feel really bad. Like, right, if you were counting that your strength being gone and you roll it, like that is awful, right? Because like there's not enough wiggle room here to do that. I think that's kind of the way I see it. Which again, I like the idea of split forces. I think to me that is one of the coolest things you get out of this. It's like the idea of these two battles happening simultaneously. And again, you're bidding here and you're bidding here. I do agree with Luke. I think going second is such an advantage here. Like I kind of wish it was a respective scoring, because I think that's a little bit more interesting as far as like if I can score it and then you can score it and then like that's a little bit different. If I score a point and then you kill my unit and you score the point, like I think that makes it a little bit more dynamic. Like as far as like the back and forth, I think now the game plan has come a little bit more straightforward. I think it's a hey, can you answer this much unit strength here and not get flanked or not get bogged down by my stuff, right? Because again, like if I'm that high unit army, I'm going to be throwing chaff in front to block you up from killing my stuff, right? Because again, all I need to do is stop you from killing me for turns 3 and 4, and I've done that. I've won the game, right? Again, it's probably easier said than done, but I mean, I think that's kind of the way I would be looking at this as a higher unit strength army, and I think this is a scenario that does very much value the higher unit strength army. I mean, not just the ogres and stuff with little points, but it's like the bigger blocks of stuff, you know. Again, I hate to say orcs get an advantage here, but like, yeah, if you have a couple blocks of orcs that are like tough to deal with, like this is actually a great scenario for you, which alone makes you kind of like it even more, right? Like if we're favoring like unit of the armies, like that's awesome. Like that's something that you don't usually see. So I kind of respect that element of it at least.
So I know I agreed with you 2 minutes ago, but I actually might be changing my mind here where unit strength doesn't matter at all until turn 6, because no list doubles their opponent unit strength, right? Like you never go below 20 unit strength, and I guess some skews are like 40. So 95% of, not 99% of matchups, you're not doubling unit strength. So if your opponent has significantly more unit strength than you, then you basically have to commit to one zone, right? Because if you spread out, if you take your 24 unit strength and do, I don't know, 16 and 8 or something, then at that point, you do actually risk getting swamped on both zones. I don't think you'll ever see both zones being scored without significant casualties. So the unit strength difference maybe doesn't really matter, aside from just sort of better to have more like it always is. So if you want to score both during the game, you have to be killing stuff, because the zones are so large that it's pretty easy to just put a lot of shit in. Like it becomes a numbers game. You don't have to overextend to do it. And then you get the toilet bowl where you're each scoring one for 3 rounds, and it comes down to the center objective, which actually is kind of cool, because unlike Dominate, where the center is that huge zone, this is an objective marker. You got to get within 3 inches of it. So then if you can zone your opponent off, then you win.
That's pretty interesting. Pretty interesting.
That's where I like this scenario, where it's like you have the ability to fight in the side. And like, again, I could, and again, I don't think it's a good strategy necessarily, but I could say I'm going to lose the right side, but I'm going to throw so much defense 6 at you. I'm going to throw so much chaff at you that you're just going to be slowed down. And you didn't, like, if you didn't put your cavalry is fast, but like, you know, they're not forsaken hordes of flying, charging fast, right? So like cavalry is not good enough to like win a side and get to the middle and win the game. Like that's not necessarily going to work for you, I think. So I do think there's ways to like slow your opponent down and to shoot them, or create a funnel of shooting changes things a lot here too, because I can create a funnel of shooting where like, yeah, you're going to the zone, but by the time you do it, you've lost so many casualties that you're no real threat to the middle. And I just got an easy 4-3, right? That's a way to win the game. I think it is. I mean, I think maybe it does end up being that way. Cause I mean, I'm the king of like, I told people, hey, if you're playing pillage or playing other scenarios, you pick 4 and you hold those. Right. And that's kind of like, that's the way I've generally recommended scenarios and played scenarios. Maybe that's the way to play the scenario. Maybe there's a way to play scenario 4-3 to say, hey, I'm going to win this, and I'm going to prevent you from getting that middle one. And that could be like a year from now, yeah, that's the obvious way to play the scenario. It's like that you pick one zone and you hold the middle, and that's the way you win the scenario. And that could be interesting too. And I'd be really curious to see how this plays out, because I think there is that could end up being a meta. And the more I think about it, that kind of ends up like, definitely if you're playing a shooting list or defensive list, that's probably the more winning strategy, I think, to kind of win by 4-3. Like, I think if you spread out, you're more likely to get blown out. Like Rob said, like, if you spread too thin, like, you end up losing, like, both sides, right? And then it's like your game plan is worth the shit. I think for alpha players, they're probably spreading more, and they're trying to look for more angles and do stuff like that. And for that, I mean, they can kind of put fast units in the middle that kind of have the ability to do that. And that's why I think terrain matters so much here, right? Because I think what you're really looking to do here is you want a unit in the middle that can make the most impact on either side. And I think that can be a game changer. I know that's like when I played flying units, my favorite unit was always having this like really threatening flying unit in the middle of the board, whether it's a monster that's sitting behind a unit that can kind of can't be charged, but can threaten, you know, a lot of angles, or it's something else. Like, you want that. And I think that's what I'm going to recommend players to, like, have that in your army, have something in your army that's in the middle that can kind of look both ways and has enough arc either way to kind of, like, you know, say, hey, don't push too far over here, or I'm going to get an angle here, or I'm going to push you there, or like, I'm going to fight you there, and I'll kill this unit, and then I'm going to use that advantage to kind of to push here and to win that. And that's where I think like there could be a lot of interesting counterplay here. I think like with that middle battle of like who's going to threaten more and who's going to push more. And I'm really curious to see how that plays out.
You said something that's really key is the terrain. We played one where there's a freaking hill on one person's side. You can't see the circle. Or maybe it's set up in a way where you can have some of your army sitting on a hill waiting for the opponent to come in and charge down off. I mean, I think terrain, and this is going to be huge. Where the blocking terrain goes can totally screw things up if you put anything anywhere near or within those circles. Same problems we have with dominant, only twice as bad because you've got two circles.
The more we talk about it, the more I think it's going to be solved in a kind of boring way where it doesn't fundamentally change the power dynamics. Like, the things that are going to be successful in this scenario are fast alpha strike stuff and shooting, because they can exert pressure without sacrificing positioning. And it really suggests that you should be contesting both zones. And I think that's going to be a losing play. But then because the final point is just an objective zone and not a larger zone, controlling it in advance to zone your opponent out of it is going to be really, really good. So it's going to be interesting. I'm leaning towards this one being pretty disappointing, but I could easily be wrong, and I hope I'm wrong.
I think terrain matters a lot. Like, I could see a strategy where, like, you alpha strike one flank and kind of hold the put your defensive units on the other side. And that, to me, that's the more interesting battle. I think that's the game you want to see, where, like, it's a race of, like, my units are going to just attack you as fast as possible. And again, maybe I just hold you in your deployment zone for, like, try to hold you for three turns, and that's enough of an advantage, right? Like that's definitely an alpha strike strategy that I could see being pretty effective, right? If I can just make you fight on your side of the table, you can't push up enough, and I'm having my dumb, like, Pegasus and units in the back just walking up and give me just enough to score that zone, and like, that's an advantage that's fine. I mean, I do like that the second turn matters more here, because I think generally that's, like, not the case. I mean, I'm a big advocate that going first is pretty much an advantage in almost every scenario. So, like, I do like that this is, like, a reversal in that. Like, to me, that's the most, probably the most interesting thing about the scenario, I think. If you look at that, it's like that you want to go second, and that kind of opens up more options for your opponent. Okay, well, you can be first and you want to go second, then I'm going to try to punish that by attacking you as fast as possible, right? And kind of, like, giving you nowhere to move, right? It's like, I think that's, to me, the play here. It's like where's the balance between, like, an aggressive army pushing one side and a defensive army that's kind of trying to, like, okay, how do I, you know, exert enough pressure to push you off and get to the middle to still win the game? You know, that might not be possible.
Fundamentally, progressive scoring should introduce tempo to the game, right? Like, you create a relationship between the tempo, so how early you can get onto the objectives to score points, in tension with attrition. So if you push up too early, you'll score the points, but then you will suffer by losing units for it. So a good progressive scoring scenario should create tension between how quickly you move up and how much you lose to do it. Does this scenario do that? Is there a play where you choose to play weak scenario round three in order to make a big play for attrition round four and five? Like, do you really blitz the center and then branch out from that? It's hard to imagine, isn't it?
It's a good question. I think so. I mean, again, if there's a command that changes, please tell us now. But like, as far as like, I mean, if I can table you, right, I table you, right? If I can kill most of your stuff and most of your toys are dead, and especially you look at most armies, again, it usually is concentrated, like Rob says, it's concentrated unit strength, right? You look at ogres, look at those. It's your unit strength is in key units, right? So if I can kill those scoring units, right? Again, that's kind of how you play dominant. It's how you play invade, right? It's killing the units that are worth a lot of points.
So does the fact that this is a progressive scenario introduce tension to that core attrition gameplay that Kings already has?
In dominant, you have six turns to kill them.
Right.
In this one, you need to kill them faster. For me personally, it felt like I was taking more risks.
Right.
I felt the need to try to really push, and I made sometimes bad decisions.
Right, right. And if this scenario can deliver that pressure to put that tension into how you would otherwise play, then it's a roaring success.
I like it. I mean, I like the idea of it. I think, there used to be a progressive scenario in the game. I don't know if people remember that. Like back, I'm trying to remember how long ago it was, probably 5 years ago at this point. But like, I think it was just like pillage, but you score points and whoever had more points won, right? But it existed and it was a thing and people played it and it went away and people forgot kind of it existed. I like it personally. I think it rewards scenario play and that's to me my favorite part about Kings of War. I think scenario, the fact that scenario is kind of king in most most games, like that's how you get your baseline score regardless of what system you're playing. It's kind of your win loss is always based on scenario, right? It's like that's what we're fighting for. I think I like the idea of this progressive idea of like it's like I can get tabled but still win the game based on like a strategy of like just holding this and component didn't react fast enough or weren't didn't understand how to react to it or whatever. Like I like the idea behind that. So I think that this is a cool idea. Even if it fails or not, like at least this to me is the right idea. Not to shit on Bulldog more, but like I think it's I think never stood a chance. I think this one stands a chance. And I think this is a cool, very cool idea. And I think this changes the game, the way you play the game in a very interesting way.
Yeah, I think even if it ends up sucking, your first 5 or 10 plays of it are going to be great.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And I think there's going to be maybe someone's going to come with some crazy army that like wins a scenario but nothing else, and like you're like I'm gonna put orcs and I'll put 40 unit strength and I'm just gonna walk in the zones and you just can't win, and that like if you do that and you win, like I'm gonna shake that person's hand and buy them a beer because that's awesome, right? Like I think if you can do that,
so 25 rich great eggs. Yeah
exactly.
To some extent, this is the book where we find out how many sort of modern mechanics we can stuff into old-fashioned Kings of War and have it work, right? Like that's a little bit the question of command dice is, does it work in Kings?
I think so.
In that respect, I'm very excited to see where things fit, whether it's good, whether it's bad, whether we can learn from it. Because, allegedly 4th edition is right around the corner. Where that corner is, who knows exactly. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see for sure. I think it's... The old world is dying and the new world struggles to be born.
The thing I like about Command Dice and what I've heard from Rob and other people, like I do see a lot of them being movement focused, whether it's Pathfinder, Order March, whatever the case may be. That changes a lot, this thing, as far as like options and in these scenarios. Most of them we talked about movement is always king, right? We talk like that's just ranks and place in a nutshell. Movement end of the day is going to win you the game, right? Units being in the right spots and planning for it. It's kind of what you want to do. So to me, having more movement options is going to be very interesting. I hope it's not like the rich get richer kind of scenario where like movement people are already fast get faster. That I think would be a loss.
I think it really is the poor get richer.
It brings the bottom up.
That's what it should be, and that's what I'm hoping it is. And if that's the case, then I think that there could be this could change things a lot. I think because again, I think infantry has generally been underpowered for multiple editions, and that's kind of how I feel at least about it.
That doesn't change this book.
Maybe not, and I hope it does. But to me, I'd like to see at least if you're on a ship and you're steering it slightly in the direction, that's what I want. I want to see steering in that direction, and whether it's like, hey, let's explore these ideas, let's explore like can Slow Infantry win, you know, Rack and Ruin if they walk in there and just die slowly? Like, can they win the scenario? Like, I hope the answer to that is yes. Maybe it's not, and maybe it's completely wrong. And if you get table on turn four, you get table on turn four, right? I don't think that changes any scenario. So I think that's probably wrong. But I like that we're asking the questions. To me, that's already an interesting concept.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, in terms of command dice, unlike Vanguard, where they're tied specifically to characters, in that game, the Basileans have an advantage because their characters are characters you were going to take anyways. So you ended up with extra dice than you really needed. And so we would call them command dice rich because they had access to command points that the other armies didn't have. In this one, everybody has a blue, red, and white, right? And red's the worst and white's the middle and blue's the best. Blue doesn't have any blank sides. Everybody gets the same amount, an average of four per turn. You know, that's the wrinkle is, do you want to reduce something in your army to free up 30 points to buy a second blue dice? And that's what we don't know. We don't know how many commands are you going to be generating per turn. I mean, if your forces of the Abyss and you have the ability to reroll regen for a turn, there's a pretty good chance you're probably going to want to do that almost every turn. And there's some armies that have ability to have crushing strength plus one on the counter charge. Kingdoms of Men have the ability to get ordered march on like knights and their infantry. You know, beast cavalry regiments can take it as well. You can do things you don't normally see. It has nimble. I mean, at the double with two pivots, I mean, there's some really interesting things that could happen there.
It's going to be really neat to see to what extent command orders are icing on the cake and to what extent they are absolutely crucial. Like, I'm a Trident Realm player, of course, so I get Pathfinder and a Barkskin token, which are both phenomenal, and Pathfinder especially.
2 points and 3 points. They're not even on the expensive side, right? Whereas so, some of them, I think Force of the Abyss, are both of them are 4 points.
Like Pathfinder is crucial, right? Like it's almost like Surge, where if you set up where you're expecting Pathfinder, you need the Pathfinder or else you're hosed. Looking at, like, you know, the last I heard, it was 3 points for Pathfinder. So I will probably be building my list so that I never get less than 3 points, which means buying two blue command dice. I will bet $100 Canadian that the most popular order is going to be strength, I think it's called, right? Reroll damage dice?
Accuracy and strength, they cost one, but you only reroll one dice. When the unit rolls to hit or melee or range, it can reroll one of the dice failed to hit. And you can't use the blast special.
Okay, that's actually pretty exciting.
That's a one-pointer, which isn't a big deal, right? You'll probably have an extra point, maybe.
It's still really good.
The way I see these kind of mechanics, and again, I think I know less than everyone combined about these kind of rules, but the way I see these is like, when these rules exist, this resource of dice and options, I think the way I see it is that the options are always king. Like, whoever has the most flexibility of how to use the right dice in the right moment is like what's ideal, I think. So like, I usually don't look for what's most powerful. Like, someone would say, oh, this is the most powerful command. This is going to work, you know, when you need it, it's the best. But I look for like, what can you do in that moment? If I need speed, I get speed. If I need hitting power, I get hitting power. If I need defense, I get defense. Like, that's what I look for in these kind of mechanics. Like, I want flexibility to do what's best in the moment. And that's kind of the way I'm going to treat these dice. So like, I'm going to look for the army that has the best flexibility in dice, and like, how can you build an army around that? It's like that. That's what I'm looking for, and I think that applies to scenarios too, right? It's like again, it's like if the big deal of this progressive scoring scenario is a big wood in your middle way, like if I can throw a Pathfinder unit, then I don't care anymore. I can just march my unit right into the woods, and they're scoring when they shouldn't have been, right? Like that's what I needed, right? I didn't need whatever else I needed, right? Like, I didn't need extra dice for my channel, my spell, or whatever the heck you're doing, right?
The command orders, they do some things like artifacts do, right? Or spells do. But the difference is the predictability isn't that necessarily. Like, a magic artifact most of the time works, right? Like, there's not many of them where you have to roll some random thing. Like, if you have J-Boots, you have Strider for the turn, right? But in command dice, you've got to roll the number of points to give yourself Strider if that's the command you have. So it maybe changes some of the predictability. But the same token, it's providing mitigation because now you have things, tools you didn't have before. Oh, I'm stuck. No, I can sidestep over my full speed, or I can back up.
And it's always exactly where you
need. That's the big one, right? It's anywhere on the table with no line of sight restriction. I mean, undead is a good example. I mean, undead, which, you know, I think everybody would argue is a little underpowered, giving them the ability to shut off shambling and giving a unit drain life 5 for a turn. So I can give it to a unit that you're going to then surge into combat. So I'm going to give it to this unit. They're going to drain life their target. They're going to get surged in. They probably have life leech. It can swing the pendulum of that combat or whatever flank you're on significantly. And so the best commands are the ones that really play into the theme. And I know people sometimes have a hard time with that, but take ogres, for example. I mean, brutal plus one. They already have brutal for the whole army. They already have brutal two if they bring the mammoth. Now they could have brutal three. Oh, and by the way, bring Kuzlo and Mathval, and now you've got four on the dice.
Yeah. Completely
changes the dice. Oh, by the way, the paymaster upgrade for a sergeant, rally one for mercs. Now you have a command to give another unit, rally one. 17, 19 warrior hordes are a lot different than 15, 17.
Hunter hordes.
Anything but chariot and siege breakers. Everything else is merc. Orcs, the ability to give them Pathfinder to get those hordes when you need to get them through. It would suck if you gave somebody J-boots and you had to pop that just to get them through the forest.
Yeah.
Now you don't have to do that. And now you have a command to do that. And they also have Brutal Plus One, which stacks with their skull pulls. The best ones are the ones that really feel like they're playing into what the army wants to do and potentially gives you additional tools that you didn't have before.
Yeah, I mean, probably Pathfinder is the best one, full stop. But
yeah, I think yeah, Pathfinder, I mean, the hordes need it, man. Let's be honest here. The hordes are so big. Like, it's such a nightmare. Like, I've seen boards where there's not an unhindered charge in the whole table, right? Like, it's like, that's very common.
Even looking at the Dambuster hordes, they have Strider and Fly. So, like, terrain is not super, super relevant. But moving the double into terrain, that's huge.
Yeah,
exactly. That's such a marginal gain on a unit that's already so flexible. But it's still incredible, right?
I agree 100%. Like, this is going back a bit, but like, I remember back when like large flying hordes had nimble and that was a thing. Like, I mean, it sounds crazy now, but like the best item you could ever give those units was Pathfinder, Caterpillar. And like, the reason why was not just for the hinder charges, is for the, I can fly 20 into woods and pivot and now threaten. It's all about space. It's all about movement.
Exactly.
And that's what you want with Pathfinder. You want to be able to march into woods so that you can get the benefit of cover. You can use that as a defensive position so they charge your hindered, and you can charge out of it, you know, maybe later. Or maybe you just want to hang out there. Like, if you get charged, and all right, well, I don't need Pathfinder there. I'll get Pathfinder to the unit now. It's going to threaten the countercharge, right? So it's like, you have a lot of flexibility there, right? And that's what I love about rules like this. I think it does raise the skill ceiling quite a bit as far as, like, knowing the right thing to pick, the right moment. And I'm excited to see it. I mean, if we tie it back to scenarios, I think again, we talked a lot about scenarios, about this kind of like split board and how to fight, you know, win enough here. And I think all it takes is one ordered march in the right moment to turn a losing game to a winning game. I think with like how close some of these flank battles are going to be. I mean, I found the same thing when I played dwarves. Like I played dwarves all of 2023 and I was ready to hang them up, and then ordered march came out. I was like, oh, this is cool. I want to try another year of dwarves. Like, I want to play more. Like, this is a whole new army now. Like, those two games I lost, I could have won those if I had an extra pivot to march to the middle to get that, you know, objective, or if I could have, you know, moved one more unit to invade and it would have scored. Like, that's all it took. So to me, I think I think it's going to be much more impactful, especially in scenario play. I think like, I'm really curious to see how that plays out.
It's going to raise the skill cap. Better players are going to be better because of command dice, because they're going to be in a better position to take advantage of these extra tools.
I think so. Yeah.
I mean, I'm really excited about the command dice.
I don't see anything broken enough to like the big one people probably look at is the reroll one. Like, you can reroll whole combat. Like, oh, okay. Like, someone's like, you make an argument that, like, I'm just going to take a like alpha unit, I'm going to throw it into you, and I'm going to reroll and try to spike your unit off the table. But, like, I think it's a bad strategy with and without command.
It could go the other way, right? You may have been slightly below average on mathematically on the dice, and you may just make it worse.
Yeah, I think you have to really understand the statistics and dice to begin with to, like, make those right decisions. And I think if you're taking, like, risky charges, this doesn't help you. I mean, I think it might help you for another situation, and you want to like claw out of it. And that's kind of interesting to me in a different respect. That's like, hey, this gives you a different avenue. Like, hey, this is a riskier charge. I wouldn't have taken this, but I'm losing. I'm going to take it, and I'm going to have the ability to bump all my command dice into it and potentially spike it. And like, that's to me, that's like a comeback mechanic, right? In a way where it's like, oh, like, I'm taking more risks there. But I like that. I think that, like, comeback mechanics could be good. And I think like, giving you an out where you otherwise had nothing might be a more interesting game. And that's like something your opponent has to play around and be ready for, right? You have to be ready for your opponent taking higher risk maybe. And that's something that we'll maybe see over time. And again, I think the faction ones, I also like the faction ones a lot because there's flavor there. I think that's something that was kind of lacking in a lot of ways, like the flavor of each army. I mean, I kind of missed that each army used to have its own special rule, and that kind of went away. I think around third edition, it was like dwarves used to have all headstrong, and that kind of like slowly went away, right? Like units just stopped having headstrong. That wasn't really talked about anymore. And like now you got like, oh, now dwarves do this. And now, you know, if you're playing, you know, goblins, they do this. If you're playing elves, they do, they're fast and they fly and they have, you know, whatever their now command dice ability is, that's now a new flavor text or flavor rule for them. And I think that's a win. I think like one of the things, I have a lot of conversations with new players and I try to tell them what each army does. I think being able to explain that with like a flavor rule, like, oh, you know, dwarves, they're kind of slow, but they order march and they kind of march quickly and they're really defensive. You know, I can say, hey, orcs do this and they're really, you know, maybe the new dwarf rules are they're all pathfinder and like you get this cool like army that's like really immune to terrain rules. That'd be kind of a cool thing to say, hey, they're an infantry army, but they kind of just ignore terrain rules. That'd be kind of really interesting if that happened. But again, I like the idea of that flavor being added to armies.
The best commands are playing into something from a design philosophy of what the army really is trying to say as a storytelling, you know, in terms of the story of the army, but also, you know, how they should be playing on the table as well. And so I think both competitive players and narrative players probably could take something out of it.
Yeah, I mean, they're multipliers, right? So the better the unit is going into the order, the more you're going to get out of it. I think really the only disadvantage to orders is the round time, like at events, right?
Yeah.
I think other than that, they're an absolute no-brainer. It might be tricky to fit in. You know, like you probably need another 5 or 10 minutes to account for them. Maybe it's a problem, maybe it's not. I hope that we see them widely adopted in North America.
I'm really excited to get you guys back on in 6 months and we can say, oh, we were wrong on this, or oh, we were dead on. This bulldog does in fact suck.
Do a reaction where we make fun of ourselves from the past. Yeah.
Sign me up.
Anything going on in your neck of the woods, Alex? Any tournaments you want to plug or anything like that?
We have Nerdhammer coming up in December. I think it's the first week in December. That's going to be in Hershey, Pennsylvania, right around Harrisburg. So that's always a blast. Run by Rob. Rob kind of co-ran.
Rob Allison, right?
Rob. Yep, Rob Allison. Yeah, he's been running tournaments forever. He runs probably, you know, best tournaments in the Mid-Atlantic. Yeah, looking forward to that. That'll be cool. That'll probably be post Clash of Kings now. So that to me is the big kind of narrative there. I think it'll be the first big GT in our region, at least for that. So we'll see what, you know, that affects to all the armies. That's coming up there. That's about it for the upcoming events in Mid-Atlantic, though.
What's going on in Canada, eh?
Nothing. But in the Pacific Northwest, in 2 weeks, so November 2nd is Rose City Rumble. So if you happen to be in Portland in 2 weeks, you should go by. The Portland Kings of War players are so lovely. I was so sad that they weren't in D.C. And then there's a little bit going on early in the new year in Tacoma, which is near Seattle. There's a GT on the 18th, 19th. I probably won't be there. You should be if you're listening to this and you're within a sensible American drive of it.
Thankful to have Alex and Luke. You know, I didn't say your last name incorrectly this time because I just let you introduce yourself. For whatever reason, I always think Joe Fraser.
It's so funny. There's a Fraser River in Vancouver where I grew up and like a Simon Fraser University. So it's like a very common last name where I'm from. So people getting it, the Fraser, I'm just like not used to.
Guys, I appreciate the time. We'll do it again real soon. Well, that's going to do us tonight. And until next time, keep countercharging.
Thanks for listening. And we'll see you next time on Countercharge. Please let us know what you thought of the show by emailing us at counterchargepodcast@gmail.com, on Twitter at countercharge15, or by commenting on the Countercharge Kings of War podcast Facebook group. If you enjoy the show, you can help others find out about it by leaving positive reviews on iTunes. Until next time, keep countercharging. Music is a composition of Kevin MacLeod and is licensed under Creative Commons.